This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 24th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article is from Amanda Hoyle. Amanda covers commercial and residential real estate. Her article is entitled, Ripe for Development. Surging land prices around Raleigh's downtown core have created many new millionaires in recent years as longtime property owners cash in on land holdings that in many instances were in their families for generations. But one of Raleigh's largest downtown property owners, the City of Raleigh, has been playing its hand like a veteran gambler. Buoyed by interest from private equity, hedge funds, and other institutional investors looking at the city core for development, Raleigh officials may soon have to decide whether holding millions of dollars in land and property on its books is a sound public policy. And similar discussions are being heard across the hallways of state and North Carolina administration offices as Governor Pat McCrory and his lieutenants sit on hundreds of millions of dollars worth of prime real estate. The sale equation becomes more plausible as North Carolina stares at a $250 million plus budget shortfall in 2015. As for Raleigh, city officials have over many, many decades amassed close to 48 total acres of commercial land, buildings, and parking lots in the downtown corridor, and almost all scattered within the city blocks south of the state capitol and Hillsborough Street. That also happens to be where most of the new privately funded infill development has been occurring over the past decade. The city-owned properties have a cumulative appraised tax value of more than $383 million, which could add more than $3.8 million in annual tax income for the city and county's general fund. About 25% of downtown land owned by the city would be classified by most real estate analysts and planners as underutilized, or properties that are ripe for redevelopment. That missed opportunity and income is not lost on municipal leaders as they, in recent months, have started reevaluating what the city's current and future needs really are in terms of office space and civic service facilities. Which city-owned properties could be offered up for sale for private redevelopment? Or which properties could be jointly redeveloped as the city as a public-private partnership? Drafts from the proposed new Raleigh downtown plan, expected to be voted on by the City Council later this summer, offer hints of possibilities for some of the city's high-profile properties. A sketch of buildings around Nash Square Park shows a dense cluster of new office and residential buildings where the Raleigh Municipal Building, or City Hall, now operates. A new parking deck with office and retail space would replace the city's 32,000-square-foot City Services Building on Martin Street. And a building labeled Boutique Hotel would replace the surface parking lot behind the News and Observer's home office. At Moore Square, where the city owns 20 parcels of vacant land and underutilized buildings, a cluster of 8-story office and residential buildings is proposed, along with a strip of retail shopping and townhouses for City Market's city-owned parking lot. The city also is evaluating implementation of a new master plan for the park and surrounding land. For the newly proposed Gateway Center, or the southern entranceway into downtown from Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, draft planners have pulled out all the stops, proposing two ambitious redevelopment options. One, an urban innovation campus of office, hotel, parking, and retail buildings, or two, a sports arena anchoring a mix of other high-rise office and hotel buildings on both sides of the rail line that bisect the properties south of South Street. The city has bits and pieces all over the place, and I want to see that part of the downtown plan addressed pretty soon, says Ann Franklin, former city council member and co-chair of the Downtown Plan Advisory Committee. Plans proposed in the new downtown plan are purely speculative since no developer with real money has filed for rezoning or site plan approval for any of these properties, but they could offer a guidebook for city leaders and private developers for what could be possible downtown. Jim Green, Raleigh's assistant city manager who oversees city's economic development and planning operations, says Raleigh officials currently are evaluating its flowchart of how it manages its real estate holdings. The city's real estate staff in July will be shifted from under the direction of the city's budget office to the planning department, reporting to city planning director Ken Bowers. Ken's staff will be able to take a more strategic look at both vacant properties and city sites and look at them from an economic development standpoint and a community development standpoint and set some priorities, Green says. In 2003, the last time a major evaluation of the city's space needs was completed, city leaders found out they had an immediate need for nearly 60,000 square feet of office space. That was solved with the $8 million acquisition of the 130,000 square foot One Exchange Plaza office building on Fayetteville Street, which is now mostly filled by city staff and operations. But what will North Carolina do? The city of Raleigh isn't alone in its surplus of properties in the downtown district. The downtown Raleigh Business District is also home to more than 70 buildings owned by the state of North Carolina and in use by 10,000 state workers each day. State-owned property in the downtown district has an assessed tax value of more than $800 million for 92 acres of land and 74 buildings, according to a review of property tax records from Wake County Revenue Department. State Budget Director Lee Roberts, though, thinks the state relies too much on its state-owned buildings, many of which are in disrepair. As we try and rationalize our spending, do we need to be spending it on older, rundown buildings, he asked? Or should we be partnering with the private sector to occupy long-term leases that are more efficient and save money? The $3 billion ConnectNC bond referendum that the governor has proposed for a vote this fall includes only a few small renovation projects to state-owned buildings in downtown Raleigh, instead focusing most of its funds on university and other infrastructure-related building projects. There are already a couple of other city-owned properties that are in play for redevelopment, and private developers are starting to line up their proposals. Back in the early 2000s, Raleigh city leaders had identified five city-owned sites that should be sold for redevelopment. Half of Site 1 in front of City Plaza on Fayetteville Street was sold for $6.3 million to developers of the 11-story Charter Square office and retail building set to open in late May. The same developer group has contracted to buy the south half of the site for an even taller mixed-use building. Site 4, a half-acre site adjacent to the Performing Arts Center parking deck at Lenore and Salisbury Street, is being sold to hotel developer Summit Hospitality, a deal that is expected to be finalized by June. Summit will be building a 170-room, 10-story Residence Inn by Marriott Hotel. Green says the city is again evaluating the best use for sites 2 and 3, the surface parking lots separating the Duke Performing Arts Center and the rest of the Fayetteville Street district. Everybody's got an opinion of what needs to go there, he says. If I ask economic development folks, they say we need hotels. If I ask homeowners, they say we need more residences and affordable housing. If I ask commercial developers, they say we need more commercial and a grocery store. There's a lot of differences in opinion. The most imminent opportunity for developers, though, is the city-owned 301 Hillsborough Street property that is being rezoned to allow for a 20-story building. Green says that after the city received a couple of unsolicited offers for the site from private investors last fall, they decided to first get the zoning clarified under the city's new Unified Development Ordinance. A vote on the new zoning is on the city council's agenda May 5. If approved, the city is expected to sell the 301 Hillsborough Street property, currently a parking lot valued at nearly $2.5 million, under the state-mandated upset bid process. The process allows 10 days for a higher bidder to make an offer, Green explains, until no higher offers are contested. We have had a ton of calls, and I think there's going to be a lot of interest in that property, he says. It's a prime location with great access. Among the bidders will be Raleigh attorney and developer Ted Reynolds, who had made a hard run to build a 23-hotel and condominium building at the 301 Hillsborough Street site in 2007, until the economic recession in 2008 spoiled his plans. At the time, he couldn't get financing and was forced to sell the property back to the city. It ended up being an expensive experiment, but it was no one's fault but fate, Reynolds says, but this is the most developable site in the city of Raleigh, and I've been lusting over it for years. Andy Andrews of Dominion Realty Partners, lead developer of Charter Square, says he'll also likely take a look at the 301 Hillsborough site. We like downtown, and we want to continue to develop downtown, he says, but he notes that Dominion will also be kicking off new building projects in Charlotte and in Atlanta over the next 4 months. But I do like Raleigh. It's my home. Next up, Jason DeBruins. Column on geriatric physician shortage that could hit the Wake-Durham area especially bad. An impending doctor shortage has been widely reported in recent years, and now a Duke University professor has raised alarm, especially as it relates to elder care. We are not a prepared nation. We are facing a crisis, says Dr. Heather Whitson, associate professor of medicine at the Duke University School of Medicine, in a U.S. News and World Report. Our current healthcare system is ill-equipped to provide the optimal care experience for patients with multiple chronic conditions or functional limitations and disabilities. Providing healthcare to be an aging population will be especially important in Wake and Durham counties. Considering that the Wake County population of those 65 years and older is expected to increase 149% to 246,811 by 2034. During the same time, the overall population will increase by 40%, and the median age will increase from 36 years to nearly 41 years, according to projections from the North Carolina Office of State Budget Management. A group of nurses say that relaxing North Carolina oversight regulations on advanced practice nurses would help alleviate the physician shortage, but doctors fearing changing regulations could affect patient safety. In Durham, the aging population growth isn't as disparate as the overall population, but it is still stark. Those 65 years and above will more than double to 64,861 by 2034, while the overall population will increase by 35%, according to the OSBM. Contributing to the shortage is the financial reality that geriatric specialists aren't paid as much as other specialties because they rely so much on Medicare reimbursements. Geriatrics is the only subspecialty where physicians can expect to ultimately earn less even though they did extra years of training, Whitson says in the U.S. News report. We need a restructuring of the reimbursement system so there isn't a financial disincentive to go down this career path. Next up, Lauren Onisorge's column on technology and entrepreneurship. Her column this week is entitled Qualcomm Snapdragon Outlook Leads to Lower Guidance. Qualcomm, a San Diego-based chip manufacturing giant, is reducing its outlook for its semiconductor business, primarily due to customer shifts impacting sales of a carry-borne technology. The company blames shifts among premium-tier customers on reducing sales of Snapdragon processors, as well as a decline in its share at an unnamed large customer, rumored to be Samsung. The company now expects to report annual revenue of between $25 billion and $27 billion, down from its previous guidance of $26.3 billion and $28 billion. Snapdragon, used in high-end smartphones, has its home in the triangle at the firm's Qualcomm Design Center. The company says it's embarking on cost-cutting measures or ongoing expense management initiatives, though it's not specific about how that might impact its North Carolina employees. Qualcomm did report $37 million in severance costs related to restructuring in its latest report, but it's unclear whether the layoffs impacted the local headcount. On Qualcomm's website, the Snapdragon team has several open engineer positions in the Triangle. Qualcomm opened its office in Cary in 2003 with just 4 people. While they no longer release a localized headcount, they had nearly 200 employees in 2008 when companies were required to release their number of employees in North Carolina. Cary was where the company's Processor Solutions Design Center was located, with 25% of phones carrying technology designed or developed at the local office. But other than confirming Snapdragon operations continue in North Carolina, the company won't detail what happens at its Triangle location, nor will they say whether Qualcomm's Triangle footprint, which includes a campus at Raleigh's Briar Creek, could be impacted by rumors of a split. Jana Partners, which is the second largest active investor in Qualcomm, has publicly pressured the firm to split its technology licensing business from its chip design division. Overall, revenue rose 8.3% to $6.89 billion in the latest quarter. Qualcomm stock was up about 2.5% in Thursday morning trading, making up all of the losses from Wednesday. The stock trades are at about $67.21 a share. Continuing with Lauren Onisarge's column on information technology and entrepreneurship, Bronto and NetSuite execs talk $200 million buyout integration plans and Durham jobs. Joe Calopi, CEO of Durham-based marketing automation firm Bronto Software, told his employees at the same time as Send was pushed on the announcement that California tech giant NetSuite was acquiring the company for $200 million. "We've been partners for years," he says, on the phone Thursday morning from American Tobacco Campus, where staff members were celebrating. "In the last year and in the last few months, the conversations got a little bit more serious." Calopi says 6 months ago, the two management teams started to concretely outline a mutual vision. "To pull that together is not an overnight feat," he says. Bronto is a global operation with facilities in Sydney and London, and there's some overlap, as NetSuite, too, has global operations. Calopi says not to expect international consolidation in the short term, but points out that the Australian facility was in need of new space anyway, having outgrown its original office. So, consolidation of those offices is possible. But he shrugs off the possibility that job cuts will factor into the equation. The plan is still to hire 100 new people at Bronto. Currently, the firm has about 260 employees, with 220 stationed in Durham. "The headcount is primarily engineering and sales," Calopi says, adding that Bronto is lean in administrative areas that typically fall victim to consolidation in a merger. Andy Lloyd, general manager of commerce projects for NetSuite, echoes the sentiment. "We think this is a fantastic area to do business," he says. "We plan on hiring more than 1,000 people this year." When you're in a growth phase like we're in, growing at 30% a year, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about getting rid of people. "No headcount reductions are anticipated," he repeats. Based on the company's portfolios, Bronto will augment what NetSuite is already doing. Currently, NetSuite's products target chief information officers and CEOs. Bronto targets the chief marketing officers with its automation technology. Lloyd, who says executives have been in Durham since Sunday, say NetSuite will be broadcasting its earnings call Thursday evening from the American Tobacco campus. He says to expect a lot of California faces in Durham initially as the two companies organize their integration strategy, but don't expect strict oversight. "They are going to help us determine our strategy moving forward," Lloyd says, adding that it's not going to be about telling Bronto what to do. "We acquired the company because they did a fantastic job growing the business," he says. NetSuite stock was trading at about 95.81 early Thursday, up less than 0.5%. Calopi and his co-founder, Chief Operating Officer Chaz Felix, founded the firm in 2002 after leaving Red Hat. Unlike other entrepreneurship stories in the Triangle, theirs is one of bootstrapping, as Calopi has consistently resisted the need to raise venture capital. And Belk, cuts CEOs' pay by 4%. This article comes to us from Jennifer Thomas, who covers retail, healthcare, and education for the Charlotte Business Journal. Belk Incorporated Chief Executive Tim Belk saw his compensation drop 4%, $3.96 million, for the fiscal year ended January 31st. This is the second year in a row his total compensation has dipped as the Charlotte-based retailer failed to meet performance goals, according to a company filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission on Thursday. In fiscal 2014, he earned nearly $4.13 million, a drop of 39% from his total compensation in fiscal 2013. Last year, the Belk's CEO's base salary was nearly $1.1 million, and he was granted stock awards of $1.7 million, non-equity incentive plan compensation of $955,533, and nearly $210,000 in other compensation. The retailer's compensation program includes multiple factors to ensure it's highly motivating, competitive, and stock-aligned, the filing states. Stockholder-aligned, I should say. Executive compensation for fiscal 2015 includes a base salary, cash incentive awards, equity incentive awards, benefits, and prerequisites. A significant portion of the compensation package is tied to performance. As previously reported, Belk's net income slid 7.8% to $146.1 million during the latest fiscal year from $158.5 million in fiscal 2014. The company attributed its decline to lower margins and higher expenses tied to investments in its strategic initiatives. Belk's net sales for fiscal 2015 totaled $4.1 billion, up 1.8% from the $4.01 billion the previous year. That was just shy of the company's performance goal of $4.15 billion for sales, according to the SEC filing. Belk confirmed earlier this month that it had hired Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated to evaluate its options for the future, a move that could result in the sale of the company. The retailer issued a statement saying it has an obligation to consider whether there are alternatives to its long-term strategic plans that would provide a better return for stockholders. The company is the nation's largest privately owned department store chain with 297 stores in 16 southern states. On Thursday, Belk also disclosed total compensation for fiscal 2015 for four other executives. They are John Belk, President, Chief Operating Officer and Director, $2,393,084. Ralph Pitts, Executive Vice President, General Counsel and Secretary, $1,506,371. Adam Orvos, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, $1,287,135. And David Zant, President and Chief Merchandising Officer, $1,253,648. Belk will hold its annual stockholders meeting at 11 a.m. May 27th at the Mint Museum in Uptown Charlotte. At that meeting, nine directors will be elected to the board. The following have been nominated for one-year terms: H.W. McKay, Belk, John Belk, Tim Belk, Erskine Bowles, Jerry DeVard, Elizabeth Valk Long, Thomas Nelson, John Thompson, John Townsend III. All have previously served on the board. Next up, Jason DeBruin's column on biopharmaceutical and healthcare industries. This column is entitled Saving Lives One Small Bottle at a Time. French microbiology company bioMérieux might not be a household name in the Triangle, but Stefan Willemsen is working to change that. While some other life science companies in the area are scaling back, such as GlaxoSmithKline, French company bioMérieux is growing. In the past few months, the company has hired some 100 new workers and plans to hire another 60 or 70, which will bump the total headcount to 750. Located in North Durham, BioMérieux makes millions of vials or small bottles filled with a special growth medium. Health professionals can take a patient's blood sample and mix it in the bottle, and within hours have a full diagnostic readout of possible diseases that infect the patient. When the company took over the site in 2001, the facility produced about 30 million bottles per year. Now production tops 100 million bottles per year. The Durham facility is the only place in the world that BioMérieux produces these blood culture bottles, so they are shipped worldwide from here. Willemsen is the top executive in Durham and corporate vice president of the Americas region and group chief legal officer. Triangle Business Journal asks, what purpose does the BioMérieux product produced here serve in the healthcare continuum? Mr. Willemsen, our product helps determine if there is an infection in the bloodstream. Often the symptoms of a severe blood infection could be similar to the symptoms of common flu, but an infection in the bloodstream could be a life-threatening situation, so you want to know as soon as possible. TBJ, what happens after blood is injected into a BioMérieux bottle? Mr. Willemsen, the bottles are placed in a machine, and depending on the disease you are testing for, you will know within 8 to 24 hours if there is an infection. These bottles don't diagnose the infection, but BioMérieux makes other products for that. These bottles tell you first and foremost if there's a blood infection. TBJ, you recently went to 24-hour, 7-day production. Why? Mr. Willemsen, business is growing and we needed to put out more product. Because we are in microbiology, our bottles actually have to sit for a certain amount of time before we can ship them. It was hard to explain to our customers that even though we had bottles, we couldn't ship them yet. Fortunately, we have caught up on our backlog. TBJ, what did the employees say about going to a round-the-clock production cycle? Mr. Willemsen, our operators actually requested it. Because we had so much backlog, we were asking our employees to log a lot of overtime, and they weren't able to plan for family vacations or holidays. They wanted a more steady work schedule. TBJ, and the company has 3 operational production lines and recently broke ground for the 4th? Mr. Willemsen, yes, we are getting that up and running now. There are a lot of regulatory hurdles in addition to the construction, but we expect it to be commercially operational by 2017. Line number 4 will become the line with the largest output. TBJ, among its goals, BioMérieux wants to fight sepsis and the growth of antibiotic resistance. Why? Mr. Willemsen, sepsis is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. It is basically a blood infection that causes your immune system and organs to shut down, which can lead to organ failure and death. But many of the symptoms are similar to the flu, so that's why it's important to have the diagnostic tools available to determine if a patient simply has the flu or has a bloodstream infection, something that is far more serious. Health professionals worldwide are facing a problem that could undo many of the medical advances from the past century because diseases are becoming resistant to the antibiotics we use to fight them. One of the reasons we face this problem is because doctors overprescribe antibiotics. TBJ, why aren't these diagnostic tools used more frequently in U.S. hospitals? Mr. Willemsen, hospital executives have many pressing issues, and the microbiology labs aren't always front of the mind, but we see that changing, particularly as these diagnostic tools help to reduce costs. TBJ, you came up through the legal side of BioMérieux. Is it difficult to work with so many scientists when your background is different? Mr. Williamson, I have learned a lot along the way and can talk intelligently about our products, but a real scientist will know pretty soon that I'm not as well-versed as they are. That's why I surround myself with people who are really good at what they do and let them work. TBJ, what is your management style? Mr. Willemsen, It's very much based on trust. I'm not a micromanager. Part of that is being humble. You can read as much as you want, but you will never be an expert like the people around you that know more. Choose your people well and then empower them and give them the resources and freedom to do the best they can. And that's usually very much appreciated. TBJ. The company recently hired 100 workers and is going to hire more. Is it challenging finding workers? Mr. Willemsen. It is challenging. We are fortunately here in an area where we have very good schools and a highly trained workforce. That said, we compete for talent with many other companies in this area, so we have to make an effort to be proactive in recruiting top talent. TBJ, what are some of your hobbies? Mr. Willemsen, I play guitar and I like European history. Of course, I watch soccer. TBJ, it must be difficult living so far away from your family. It is, but it has become our... I beg your pardon. Mr. Willemsen replies, it is, but it has become our life. I have to be in France about once a month, so I take the weekend before and after to visit them. TBJ, do you have any cures for jet lag that you'd like to share with us? Mr. Willemsen, I try to sleep as much as I can on the plane and stay with the old time as much as possible. I don't force myself to switch. This week's column on running the family business is by Mr. James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. His column this week is entitled, Avoid These Common Mysteries in Running a Family Business. There's really no mystery surrounding most of the people-related challenges faced by family businesses. A lot of them result from the interactions of business imperatives with family values and relationships. But some things seem to happen a lot more frequently in family business and family-owned businesses than in other companies. Here's a short list of family business mysteries. Mystery number one, the mystery of the unfiltered gene pool. This features the family-owned company that becomes a haven for every family member who wants a job or wants an income. Although the hiring criteria for non-family employees are probably quite clear, the company has no threshold requirements for family members. When a company declares that every relative who's able to get off the bus at the right stop is assured of a regular paycheck, it quickly becomes less of a business and more of a welfare fund. An open-door policy has siphoned the life out of more than one good company, so the mystery is how any family business that's run like this can stay afloat. Mystery number two, the mystery of the purloined prerequisites. Smart companies treat perks as part of total compensation, amenities to be earned by performance, rank, or longevity. Being promoted to a vice presidency, for example, might carry with it the use of a company car, weekends at the corporate beach house, or other goodies. Here's the mystery. Why do some family-owned businesses provide perks simply on the grounds of family membership? Comforts that flow down through the family aren't the same as rewards for hard work, creativity, and commitment. There should be nothing mysterious about the difference. Mystery number three, the mystery of the out-of-control ownership. My friend Max distributed stock in his retail clothing company to his kids, his sisters, their kids, and their kids' kids, but he didn't distribute all the stock, and he didn't distribute voting stock. With a little forethought and some good advice from his attorney, Max ensured the long-term interest of his family in the stability and success of the company. But he didn't give away the store, and he didn't turn loose of management control. Smart guy. So it's truly mystifying that more family-owned businesses don't do likewise. Too many senior family business owners hold on to every possible shred of ownership, making other family members jealous, suspicious, and ready for rebellion. And now it's time for a better world. News and events on the state of philanthropy in North Carolina, presented by Todd Cohen. Mr. Cohen publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. SAVE helps curb student violence. 20% to 30% of U.S. students say they have been bullied at school, while 70% of young people say they have seen bullying in their schools. Working to prevent violence by raising awareness among students, helping them manage conflicts, and engaging them in service projects in their schools and communities is the National Association of Students Against Violence Everywhere, or SAVE, a Raleigh-based nonprofit. School violence has become more accepted in society, says Carlene Ray, executive director of SAVE. We are desensitized to it. Students are growing up with bullying. Starting with a group that students at West Charlotte High School created in 1989 after the death of a student who was trying to break up a fight at an off-campus party, SAVE now has established 2,140 chapters in 48 states and 7 countries. SAVE operates with an annual budget of $250,000. It gets 75% of its funds from contribution and the rest from annual dues and the sale of educational materials and items, in-kind support, and an annual summit that in March attracts 400 people from 8 states. At Garner High School, with part of a $75,000 grant to SAVE from Allstate Insurance, to promote safe driving efforts at 20 North Carolina chapters, faculty advisor Vicki Sarzik is working with students to raise awareness about auto accidents, which are the main cause of death among teens. At Chapel Hill High School, SAVE students painted over a graffiti-filled wall and cleaned up garbage in the area to create a peace garden. SAVE, formerly a program of the State Center for the Prevention of School Violence, became a separate nonprofit in 2001 when it also received a 5-year grant of $350,000 per year from Chevrolet that helped it add at least 200 chapters per year. Bullying, physical assaults, drug deals, and other violence and crimes have become a norm in elementary, middle, and high school, Ray says. While metal detectors may help improve the security of schools, she says, understanding the family, mental, and other issues that students bring with them to school is critical to prevent violence. We really try to reach students and give them the life skills and education and knowledge to create safe environments for themselves, in their school, and in their community, she says. To help do that, SAVE focuses on relationships among students and with teachers and administrators. Bullies bully, for example, because of an imbalance of power, Ray says. You aren't a victim unless it's continued and repeating, she says. If one other student steps up for a student being targeted, bullying is more likely to stop. A key to preventing youth and school violence is to talk to kids, Ray says. They have wonderful ideas. They know what's going on in the school and community, and they truly want to make a difference and be part of the solution. Up next, Duke Spinout loses $600 million of market value, 72% of the company value. Duke University spin-out drug developer Aerie Pharmaceuticals lost 72% of its market value after it reported negative trial results. In real dollars, that means Aerie investors lost more than $600 million on paper. Aerie is developing a series of treatments for glaucoma and other diseases of the eye. It reported Thursday that a Phase 3 trial named Rocket 1 did not meet its primary endpoint. Always bad news in drug development. In this case, Aerie's experimental drug, Rhopressa, did not lower intraocular pressure in patients with glaucoma or ocular hypertension better than existing treatments. During drug development, scientists tested their experimental treatments. In Aerie's case, the company wanted to show that Rhopressa, a once-daily treatment, could perform as well as existing treatment, Timolol, a twice-daily treatment. We are obviously disappointed that we missed the primary endpoint for Rocket 1. We expected Rhopressa to demonstrate better performance based on the results we saw in the previous Phase 2B studies, said Vincent Anito, Aerie chairman and CEO. He pointed out that there were some positive takeaways from the trial and that the results from a second trial named Rocket 2 could be more promising. We look forward to our Rocket 2 efficacy results expected in the third quarter and 12-month safety results expected by the end of 2015. Rocket 2 results are expected to inform our future strategies, including the potential need for an additional Rhopressa Phase 3 registration trial. In addition, we are well prepared to commence the quadruple action Roclactin Phase 3 trials later in 2015. At the end of the first quarter, Aerie had $179 million in cash and investments. Anito said the company was well financed to proceed with our key strategies. And UNC researcher bags $8 million to study therapies that target Crohn's disease. UNC healthcare researcher Dr. Michael Kaplan received $8 million to compare the effectiveness of two drug therapies in the treatments of Crohn's disease in children. The funding comes from the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI, PCORI, an independent nonprofit organization authorized by Congress in 2010. Crohn's disease is an inflammatory bowel disease that affects approximately 38,000 children in the U.S., causing debilitating abdominal pain and bloody diarrhea and leading to frequent hospitalizations and surgery. There's no standard therapy, and treatments typically involve a combination of drugs with varying and sometimes risky side effects. According to the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America, Crohn's disease may affect as many as 700,000 Americans of all ages. Men and women are equally likely to be affected, and while the disease can occur at any age, Crohn's is more prevalent among adolescents and young adults between the ages of 15 and 35. Treatment typically involves suppressing inflammation with drug therapies, balancing potential benefits against risks that can be life-threatening, explains Kaplan, an associate professor of pediatrics in the UNC School of Medicine. Patients turn to their child's gastroenterologist to guide them in health decisions, but there are gaps in research where we can't definitively say which therapy is better. Kaplan hopes to close one of those gaps with this research project. Anti-tumor necrosis factor, or anti-TNF, drugs are a class of drugs that have been used for more than a decade in the treatment of inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. Most recently, they have had an impact in the treatment of Crohn's disease. What remains unknown, however, is whether using anti-TNF drugs alone or in combination with methotrexate, another immune suppressant, leads to better outcomes. Kaplan's research team, which includes investigators from more than 50 pediatric gastroenterology programs across the country, will enlist 425 individuals under 18 years old with moderate to severe Crohn's disease who are initiating anti-TNF therapy. Participants in the double-blind study will be randomized to receive either anti-TNF plus low-dose oral methotrexate combination therapy or anti-TNF alone monotherapy, and they will be followed for 2 years. It presents a tremendous opportunity to generate strong scientific knowledge that will directly inform and impact patient care, and for the pediatric gastroenterology community to further integrate research and clinical care so that we can learn from each other and every patient encounter, says Kaplan. Jason DeBruin's column on biopharmaceutical and healthcare industries has an article entitled Major Shift to Private Exchanges? Not so fast. North Carolinians buying health insurance through their employer are paying higher premiums and shouldering more cost of their medical bills. As a result, some health insurance experts predict a shift toward private health exchanges. An Accenture report estimates that more than 100% annual growth in private exchanges since 2013 and predicts that trend will continue. Not so fast, says Skip Woody, partner at health benefits consultant Hill, Chesson & Woody. He says that while the growth in these plans is steep, the numbers are skewed because the baseline started so small. Fewer than 2% of the 150 million or so Americans who buy employer-sponsored health insurance buy from these buy from these private exchanges. Furthermore, Woody questions whether these exchanges will reduce cost. These exchanges operate much like the health insurance marketplace created under the Affordable Care Act, in which individuals comparison shop for insurance plans. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, for example, offer the Blue Benefits Center as its version of a private exchange. To be sure, Woody doesn't see himself as a contrarian. Indeed, he points out benefits to both employers and employees of these plans. He just doesn't see them as a panacea or as an option that will grow to 40 million members by 2018, as Accenture predicts. Most employers offer only one or two insurance options to employees. By sending employees to the exchanges, employers can offer their workers more insurance options. However, they nearly always come with higher costs, as well as oftentimes when you have that many choices, you are charged more than if you had one choice, Woody says. More options don't necessarily mean lower cost. Consider a shopper who is sold a pair of shoes for $150. If that shopper is offered three other pairs of shoes for $50, $100, and $200, it doesn't mean that original pair will sell for any less. Choice doesn't equate lower cost, Woody says. The private exchange is not a cost savings tool. It's not a silver bullet by any means. It's not going to slow the rate of healthcare inflation. Lauren Owen-Sorge had a conversation with Janet Cowell, and she asked five questions about North Carolina's Innovation Fund II. State Treasurer Janet Cowell says the newly announced Innovation Fund II, a coffer of $250 million aimed at gathering returns for pensioners and fueling innovation in the state, is big news for North Carolina entrepreneurs. This fund, to be managed by existing partner Grosvenor Capital Management, was an easier sell than the $232 million Innovation Fund I, she says. The last time we did this in 2010, it was about a year, the total process, she says. This time around, because we already had Fund I and a good experience, we went ahead and just upped with the existing partner. TBJ, first question. Why is Innovation Fund II important for entrepreneurs in the state? Ms. Cowell. It means another source of funds for entrepreneurs in the state, and obviously a continuation of opportunity from the treasurer's office. Question 2. TBJ. What do entrepreneurs and business owners need to understand about the fund? Ms. Cowell. They can go to ncinnovationfunds.com and understand what our fund finances. We are from early stage to growth stage, as well as ongoing concerns. Very developed companies with a lot of ongoing revenue. We do cover a spectrum, and it is private equity. So it's very high growth firms, 20% type of returns. On our website, we do have other sources of funding around the state. So if your company doesn't fit with the profiles we're looking for, there are other sources of funding. Question 3, TBJ. What's the time frame for the fund? When will we see investments? Ms. Cowell, probably in the next 2 or 3 months. We have a few remaining funds in Fund 1, but we're pretty much at the end of that. Question 4, TBJ. Have companies already been vetted? Ms. Cowell, no. We are still working on the contracts. Question 5. TBJ. What's the takeaway for pensioners in this announcement? Ms. Cowell. The fund is to get a high return for pensioners, so that is the utmost goal. Fund 1 has a 20% return right now. This second fund has the same goal as always about returns. The secondary goal is to create jobs and help the economy. With money comes the ability to expand facilities and hire. Next up, is Yadkin Bank 6 months away from its next deal? CEO talks deal flow, job cuts. If history is to be believed, Yadkin Bank could be 6 months away from its next deal. In an interview Thursday with the Triangle Business Journal, Yadkin CEO Scott Custer talked about both deal flow and the latest restructuring, a move that, according to securities filings, means branch closures and job cuts. Custer says part of his job is keeping conversations going with potential partners, and that he's always eyeing potential opportunities, and that means acquisitions. I would say that I have lots of discussions, and we're certainly interested in continuing to grow the company, he says, adding that there's nothing imminent in the works, but the bank's pattern has been a deal nearly every 15 months. And the Yadkin deal with Raleigh's Vantage South Bank closed in July. It's kind of hard to predict these things using a calendar, he says. They really are much more as the situation presents itself and the stars line up and you find a partner that has similar views than you and it just works out. Custer has led several deals prior to taking the helm at Yadkin, notably the move in 2012 that had Piedmont Community Bank merging Vantage South Bank into Crescent State Bank. Custer wouldn't be specific about where the closures would happen. I really can't right now because we're still in the process of some customer notifications that have not been completed, he says. And the company is still growing, despite the cuts, he notes, pointing to the new branch opening soon in Raleigh. On the job cuts, nor would Custer be specific as to how many job cuts to expect. He did say that the total is likely to be in the mid-20s range. They are primarily staff and back office positions that have largely been deemed to be redundant once we got through to the other side of the integration, he says. Yadkin, which reported its first quarter's earnings early Thursday, was trading at $19.70 per share, down more than 1% by mid-afternoon. And Highwoods announces top executive changes with Harris's retirement. Highwood Properties announced several big changes among CEO Ed Fritch's executive team at headquarters in Raleigh. Mike Harris, Highwood's chief operating officer, will be retiring on August 31st. Harris, 65, has been with the company since 1996, when Highwoods acquired Crocker Realty Trust, where Harris had been an executive vice president. He was promoted to executive vice president and chief operating officer in 2004. Succeeding Harris, according to a news release late Wednesday, will be Ted Kleinick, Highwoods' chief investment officer. Kleinick, 49, was hired in 2012 as the Raleigh-based Real Estate Investment Trust's chief investment officer, and he will keep that title also following the transition. The company also announced that David Dubman, 36, has been promoted to Vice President of Operations and Analysis. Mike Harris has been a terrific business partner, leader, and inspiration to our team, Fritch says. It has been an honor to have worked alongside Mike for almost 2 decades, and the entire Highwoods family applauds him as he finishes his long and distinguished real estate career, which will always be held in the highest regard. Next up, RDU Terminal 1 demolition planning moves ahead. The final phase of Raleigh-Durham International Airport's Terminal 1 reconstruction project is underway, tearing down what's left of the old building. The demolition process will begin in early 2016, says RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin. The project is expected to cost between $6 million and $7 million. Terminal 1 reopened last summer after a $68 million renovation and is primarily occupied by Southwest Airlines. Raleigh-based architecture and engineering firm Clark Nexon is handling the design portion of the project under the $972,137 contract it was awarded in February. The RDU board approved Balfour Beatty Construction's $199,635 contract for the project during its most recent meeting in March. The airport is also in the process of developing a long-term master plan, which will include a number of infrastructure projects designed to carry RDU through the next 25 years. Hamlin said RDU's board has authorized airport officials to begin negotiating with Recondo and Associates Incorporated to act as a consultant on developing the master plan. The beginning phase of the master plan is expected to be completed by early 2017. And North Carolina Commerce Board greenlights grant for Franklin County factory expansion. A State Commerce Department authority signed off on a $500,000 grant that will allow Franklin County to expand a Lewisburg building currently occupied by the Palziv Foam Products Company. Palziv North America, the U.S.-based subsidiary of Israel-based Palziv, is planning a $6.35 million expansion to its plant and North American headquarters in Lewisburg. The expansion is expected to create 50 new jobs in Lewisburg, about 30 miles north of Raleigh. Franklin County offered a 5% match, or $25,000, in order to obtain the $500,000 grant from the State Rural Infrastructure Authority, which oversees the state-backed building reuse program. The grant will be used to help Palziv North America add 60,000 square feet to its existing facility, according to the documents provided by the RIA. It was one of the more than a dozen grants approved by the RIA during a Thursday meeting. Palziv North America's Lewisburg facility serves as a distribution and logistics center. The additional space will allow the company to expand its production areas. The company produces polyethylene foam-based products used in packaging, automotive, construction, orthopedic, and leisure industries. It currently employs 92 people in Lewisburg. He's Not Here, a popular bar and beer garden on Chapel Hill's Franklin Street, has landed the Daily Meal's 150 Best Bars in America 2015. Judges for the food and drink website chose the 150 bars based on several factors, including drinks, mixology, bartenders, decor, experience, and cuisine. He's Not Here, called a true old-school college bar, includes a beer garden that can accommodate 1,000 rowdy college kids. And, of course, there are those ubiquitous blue cups. It's the only North Carolina bar on the list, which includes 25 bars in New York City, 13 in Chicago, and 11 in San Francisco. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.